Shrink Wrap Radio number 499, An Evolutionary Theory of Dreaming, with Finnish psychologist Dr. Antti Revonsuo.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. Antti Revonsuo, a Finnish psychologist widely known for his threat simulation theory of dreaming. For more information about Dr. Revonsuo, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Hey everybody, we've got a new sponsor, and it's our longtime strategic partner, the Neuropsychotherapist. This week's featured article in the Neuropsychotherapist is Remembering in Order to Forget by Paul Simpson and Robin Tysik. You'll find it at neuropsychotherapist.com, which is the beautifully illustrated online monthly magazine for psychotherapists and anyone else interested in the intersection between the latest neuroscience findings and psychotherapy. I want you to go to neuropsychotherapist.com and get your free introductory issue today. And I'm hoping that will inspire you to support their superlative work by subscribing to it. Now, let's go to the interview. Dr. Antti Revonsuo, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
Well, I'm pleased to have you on the show. I see that you're going to be a keynote speaker at the International Association for the Study of Dreams in the Netherlands this June. And I've had a long-standing interest in dreams myself. But I have to confess, I've only just recently learned of your threat simulation theory of dreaming. So I apologize for being slow in that regard.
No problem. I think it's quite a new idea. So not many people maybe have heard about it yet. But I hope more people will hear about it in the conference and elsewhere.
Yeah, and on this show, certainly. But before we get into that, let's take a step back and have you share with us how you first got interested in psychology.
I think dreaming actually was playing a role there. When I was in senior high, I was already interested in psychology, but I was a little bit disappointed that we didn't hear that much about dreaming, because I was paying attention to my own dreams and always very curious about what are they really. I had some lucid dreams or pre-lucid dreams, and some other weird dreams that I kept thinking about, and I was really very curious to find out more about them. And I was borrowing some books from the library. I think I even read Freud's Interpretation of Dreams when I was still in senior high school. But dreaming was one of my big motivations to go to the university to study psychology, although I didn't learn that much about dreaming during my studies there. So
that's pretty typical.
Only afterwards. Yeah.
Pretty much the same here for most psychology programs. Now, did you start to study psychology as an undergraduate, or did that come later in graduate school?
I started as an undergraduate. Actually, here in Finland, if you want to become a psychologist, then it's a five-year program, and it's undergraduate and graduate, it's all the same. So you need to always start and go through the whole 5 years. You can't switch in between. So I started from the undergraduate, and then it basically seamlessly continues for the whole of 5 years, the psychology program over here.
I think a lot of people over here would like that approach better. it's somewhat quicker, I think, than over here. And you talked about your early interest in dreams. Did you ever keep a dream journal, for example?
Yeah, when I had graduated and I was wondering if I should go to research or to become a clinical psychologist or neuropsychologist, and then I started to get really interested in both consciousness and dreaming, but there was nobody at my university who had done anything, any research on dreaming, so I just started out as a kind of a hobby with my some of my friends who were also studying psychology, and together we started to have a sort of a small dream group, and we all of us were writing down our dreams, and then we were discussing them, and we were trying to induce lucid dreams, and then gradually from that I started to I also was keeping a dream journal, and I started to think about, would it be really possible to really carry out some solid research into dreaming as well. So it started out as a kind of a hobby, and then it turned out to be one of the lines of my research.
Sure. And have you ever had what Jungians would refer to as a big dream that somehow impacted the course of your life?
Yeah, I would say so. I think I had a very interesting kind of a pre-lucid dream when I was maybe about 15 or so, a false awakening as well. It was where I woke up in my own bed, and I went just like in a normal morning. I went to the kitchen, and my parents were there having their morning tea and reading the newspapers, and then I was listening to they were reading some news from the newspaper, and then some of the news just didn't make any sense. It was just some person was supposed to be the member of parliament, and I knew that person is just some kind of different celebrity, and I commented on that, and then my parents looked at each other and said that, oh, he has gone crazy now. And then I started to really wonder, is this real? Don't I know anymore what is true and what is false? Or is this a dream? And I was looking out the window, and I was knocking at the kitchen table and everything, and this feels so real, that must be real, can't be a dream. So, and then I woke up in my own bed again, this time for real, but it made me really wonder, is this now real or is this still a dream? And that dream was something that I kept wondering about for many, many years, always wondering, what was that place where I was, trying to find out, is it a dream or is it a reality? So that was, I think, one of the dreams that kept my curiosity aroused all the time, wanting to really find out what dreams are.
Yeah, really, that was a pretty amazing experience. Now, you mentioned that at one time you were kind of split. Would you specialize in clinical or in research or in the neuroscience? Which way did you end up going?
Well, For a while I went a little bit both ways. We have, in psychology studies, you have to do an internship at the before finishing the study. So then I was working at the neurological clinic with the neuropsychologist supervising me. So I did get a picture, because until then I had been actually quite sure that I want to be a clinical neuropsychologist. But then I saw what the work really is like, and I realized that it will get boring after a couple of years, because they have a huge pressure to diagnose patients and test patients and write statements about them and stuff like that. And then I started to become more interested in doing research. And fortunately, there were a couple of research projects that were looking for new PhD, beginning PhD students. And the second one was then at the Department of Philosophy. And then I went there and I suggested, is it okay if I have a research plan in my mind already about consciousness-related issues, and dreaming was one of those ideas. And then I got in to that project, and after I had been there for a while, I realized that this is what I really want to do. I really want to read and understand anything relating to consciousness, and dreaming was one part of it. But of course, nobody of my supervisors knew anything about it, so I kept a little bit quiet about it before I was able to start running some research by myself, because I knew that nobody will take me very seriously if I'm just talking about dreaming, because it's a difficult topic when you are dealing with scientists and people who want to do some hard science. Then dreaming doesn't sound like the first thing that comes to mind.
Right. Believe
so
me.
So I kind of smuggled it in gradually into my PhD project, and And after it became, after I got my first publication out from Dream Research, then it was kind of legitimate to carry on.
Yeah, I totally understand. I went through something pretty similar. I ended up doing my doctoral research on the role of attention in hypnosis and meditation. And
okay.
Today, those are hot topics. But at the time, nobody on my committee really understood what I was up to. And it was just out of because they liked me. I think that they were willing to support me.
Yeah, yeah. I was also running very different types of studies in my PhD project. We need to publish articles, peer-reviewed articles. So I published a couple of articles which were very neuropsychological on aphasic patients' ability to process information consciously and unconsciously, and then some more philosophical topics on consciousness and the problem of consciousness. But then also some couple of papers on dreaming. So it was kind of a mixed bag, but I wanted to smuggle in the topic of dreaming, although actually nobody was really supervising me on that. But I knew that if I get something published in any peer-reviewed journal, they will like it anyway.
Yes, right, exactly.
So that's how it happened pretty much, that I became a dream researcher, a little bit like self-made one, but anyway.
Well, that's great. That's great. Now, people have long speculated on whether dreaming developed to serve some evolutionary survival purpose. What led you to develop your own evolutionary theory?
Yeah, I was always, I mean, I studied biology as a minor, and my father was a biologist, so I had a kind of a biological perspective in general in psychology. And then I was in my first studies and also more theoretical philosophical studies, I was trying to define what kind of a phenomenon dreaming is, and I ended up with a sort of a definition that dreaming is like a world simulation. It simulates the perceptual world, or it is like a virtual reality.
Mm-hmm.
Going on in the brain, a sort of a like a biologically programmed virtual reality that gets activated every night for us. And then after I had come up with this sort of a definition of dreaming, then this functional question came up, and I started to wonder, well, but that must take a lot of effort and energy and organization from the brain to be able to do such a thing, because it's pretty complicated stuff to simulate, for example, the social world, other people that we see in our dreams going about their business and stuff like that.
So good point.
It must be pretty complicated. You can't just, the brain can't do it just somehow randomly, like many theories assume that it must be the result of some kind of random activation or a side effect of random activation.
Yes.
But I thought that dreaming wouldn't be an organized, simulated world if it was the result of a random activation. So then I just came up, I started to think that, okay, but what do we, when we use simulators or virtual reality, what do we use it for? And the first thing that came to my mind was flight simulators. And
yeah.
that they have a very clear purpose, because you need to train pilots to handle emergency situations. And it's quite risky to do that with a real plane, to go through all sorts of things. And it's just not even possible to come up with all sorts of scenarios while flying a real plane. So, of course, we need a flight simulator, and the pilots can go through very, maybe, situations that happen very infrequently, and then they have this already a pattern of responses fresh in their mind, because they have gone through all these various risky situations in the simulator, and it feels pretty much like really being in the plane. It looks like that, and it feels like that, and all the equipment is exactly identical. And from that, I thought, well, if dreaming is also a simulation, maybe the brain is using it in the same way for us to go through very risky situations that would be too risky to practice and rehearse in the real life, because there is a great risk that you will not survive if you start
crash and burn. Yeah, you'll crash and
yeah,
burn.
Yeah, exactly. But if you do that as a simulation, there are almost no risks and very little costs, only the kind of energy cost that it takes from the brain to keep up this kind of high-level activity that you can actually feel that you are in a real world. Also, that unlike the pilots who are in the flight simulator, they know that they are in a flight simulator and it's not a real plane, even if it's kind of deceptively looking like the same. But when we dream, we have no idea that it is a dream. We take everything like very seriously, unless we are lucid, and that happens very rarely, and it's very difficult to keep lucidity up. So then I just really thought that this seems to be an idea that might work, that it kind of combines the fact that there are no risks to simulate dangerous situations, and it's also a good idea to make us forget that it's not for real, because then we take all the dreamed threats and situations as if they are really happening in reality, and we try to solve them, and we try to escape, and we try to really find solutions and reasonable reactions to all sorts of threats that would be very unlikely, but we don't even realize how unlikely they are when we are within the dream. And then I started to just read the literature, because at that point I actually wasn't that well aware of the literature on nightmares or post-traumatic dreams or things like that. And when I was reading about post-traumatic dreams, for example, Hartman's articles and books, because he was writing a lot about post-traumatic nightmares, and I thought, wow, it's so fascinating, but it seems to work exactly as this kind of a theoretical idea would predict, that you encounter something very threatening, your life is maybe threatened in the real world, and then after that, your dreams will start to make you go through similar situations every night until you have, in a way, like rehearsed them sufficiently. And then after that, if nothing happens, maybe your dreams, your post-traumatic dreams, gradually they become less frequent. But if you encounter a similar situation or something reminds you of that old traumatic situation, the nightmares come back immediately, as if that you are cued that maybe something similar is again about to happen, so you need to be prepared again.
Yeah.
So these sorts of things in the literature made me feel that, well, this could really be an idea that explains maybe, perhaps not all kinds of dreams, at least a very big portion of dreams, like nightmares, bad dreams, post-traumatic dreaming, and recurrent dreams in children and also in adults, because there are very similar themes that they go through, and they seem to have these kind of like scripts for threats that are very common and universal in people's dreams. And then this connected my ideas to that, well, but maybe the origin is evolutionary, that life was so much more dangerous in human evolutionary history, when we were living as hunter-gatherers. So the environment was full of all sorts of dangers from nature, and it would have been a good idea to get prepared for those. And again, when I looked at what are the most universal themes in nightmares and bad dreams, so the theme of being attacked, being chased by wild animals, by unknown bad guys and stuff like that, that sounded to me like, well, this seems to be something that must have been a major threatening situation during all of our evolutionary history. but it's not that commonly encountered by us who live in the safe Western societies. We don't need to run away from wild animals or even bad guys, at least not very often. So
yeah, let me just jump in for a moment here.
Yeah.
So this seems like a really original line of thought and very compelling as I hear you lay it out. It's sort of like, oh yes, this really makes a lot of sense. And also you refer to, another observation I wanted to make, the metaphor, if you will, of virtual reality. And of course, right now, there's a lot of excitement in the whole gaming world, let's say, about virtual reality and the kinds of even more compelling virtual reality games and equipment that will be coming soon. And one of the things that's interesting to me is how, in a sense, Freudian those things are in terms of emphasizing the aggressive side, you know, of Freud's theory about dreaming and about our basic personality. And so it seemed, you know, you mentioned that flight simulators were the first thing, but somewhere pretty close on the heels are war virtual simulations, both in the military,
right,
but especially consumer things. We've got all of these very violent, sorts of virtual reality experiences, both that we have now and that are probably on the way. So in a way, that kind of also, in a certain way, confirms some of what, on what you ended up focusing on, which was threat. And at first I thought, well, why threat? But you've really laid it out very nicely. Now, you sent me some of your articles, and in your before I go there, you mentioned Hartman. And I had an opportunity to hear Hartman speak at one of the IASD conferences, like the one that you're going to be presenting at. And the thing that sticks in my mind from his presentation, if I remember it correctly, is that the post-traumatic dreams are not exact replays of the traumatic experience. Am I remembering that right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that was kind of surprising, because in popular media, movies, and so on, we've been led to believe that the person is reliving the exact experience.
Yeah, that's right. I guess Hartman was one of the first ones who really pointed it out, and that there is a sort of a time window. I think he said that it's usually a few months during which the post-traumatic dreams gradually change, and the first ones immediately after the trauma, they are most similar to the original experience, but even those are not entirely identical. But then they become more diverse, and they become connected with perhaps other threatening situations in one's life, perhaps some horror movie scenarios or something like that. They become more and more connected, and his idea was that the function of dreaming is more like emotion regulation function, that these very emotionally difficult experiences become connected in our memory networks and in emotion networks to lots of other experiences, so that we can, in a way, like deal with them, and that they are not so horrifying anymore. They become just part of normal life, so to speak, and part of our normal memory. So he saw it as a kind of a calming down process, which is a quite different idea from what my idea was about what the function of dreaming is. But I think it would make sense.
Wouldn't your theory also, you know, to the extent that it's a rehearsal for dealing with threat, wouldn't yours also postulate a calming down, an ability to be less reactive emotionally?
That's right. If this, whatever triggers the post-traumatic dreams, if it's a single event, like some catastrophe where you are involved, and then it's over, then we probably would see this kind of a pattern that the dreams are first very, very active, then they become less and less frequent, and they become also more diverging from the original theme and connecting it to different kinds of scenarios. And that would also make sense from the simulation point of view, because it's very unlikely that we encounter exactly the same situation in an exactly the identical manner. Rather, it's good to be prepared to encounter in the future some variation of that type of threatening situation. But if your environment doesn't show you any cues that anything like that is going to happen, then those dreams gradually, like, okay, you have now rehearsed for that, but there is nothing that shows that anything like that will happen, so you don't need to dream about that right now. But if something reminds you of that very strongly, then the dreams come up again. And this is what many people with recurrent nightmares say, that and post-traumatic dreams, that if something reminds them of the original event, then the nightmares come immediately back, as if they would need to prepare again, that the brain has detected, hey, there is a potential threat upcoming, let's get ready if it comes.
Yeah. Now, historically, I mean, prehistorically, we would have experienced different kinds of threats than we experience today. So, you know, a long time ago, maybe it was a saber-toothed tiger, and today it's my boss looking at me funny. Is it basically that same mechanism is in our brain and can be triggered by maybe lesser but current threats?
Exactly. I think the system is flexible, but we can see that it seems to come with kind of like default settings. Mm-hmm. Because if we look at children's nightmares and bad dreams, they are full of these sorts of these universal being chased by a monster type of dreams, and they are very sensitive. Children are very sensitive to that type of stimuli as well. And now, if we think about how children grew up maybe in a hunter-gatherer environment, that they were observing wild animals and dangerous animals in nature all throughout their childhood, and learning which ones are dangerous and in what way they are dangerous. So very naturally, they were probably also dreaming about animals. And we know that also children still, they dream much more about animals than adults do, that the percentage of animal characters goes down as children grow up. And they also, children are also very sensitive in taking in from the media various characters that look a little bit like monsters are somehow frightening. Like here in Finland, for example, we have a cartoon going in the TV, famous here, called Moomin cartoons. And there is one kind of strange character which is called some kind of a ghost that's going just around in the forest. It doesn't hurt anyone, but it looks scary. And in one study where they had interviewed lots of children here, it came out that this character was the leading character in their bad dreams. So children are very sensitive to picking up what is the potential monster or the potential predator in the environment. And then you start to have dreams where that character is going to chase you and attack you in your nightmares. But later on, the system seems to really be flexible. And if we look at adult nightmares in adults, well, there is still this being chased and being attacked, still a leading theme. But then we have these much more modern themes like being late from a flight or being late from a lecture or an important exam, or you try to call and your phone is not working, or sure, your computer crashes. I think last week I just had a dream where I was preparing a lecture or doing something with my laptop, and then it started to go really weird. The seen, and I tried to push Control Alt Del. I tried to do everything to control it, and oh no, it's a virus, and what will I do now? All my lectures are there, and how will I prepare? Can I still reboot it? And, you know, very, very modern threat, so to speak, but also very real to me.
Yeah, that is a real nightmare.
that is. And actually, then when I was thinking about it, I was worried about having a virus or something, because my computer, the same laptop, it crashed a couple of times just during the last few days, but then there was no problem. It just rebooted normally. But I remember I was thinking about, why is it doing something like this now? That is there some virus or what is the problem? And then this came to my dream, and I remember even in the dream I was pushing Control Alt Del and nothing happened.
Yeah.
I was kind of amused at how accurate it can get with this kind of a very, very modern threat. But there was still the same fear as in any other nightmare when you see something like much more primitive type of fear.
Yeah. You know, going back to the children's sensitivity to monsters, it just made me wonder if you think that there might be anything genetic involved. Do you think that we have somewhere stored in our brains genetic memories?
That's an excellent question, and I've been thinking about that how is it possible that that children start to have these types of nightmares, which seem to be very stereotypical, that there is a monster or a wild beast or a bad guy chasing them, attacking mm-hmm. them, and they are trying to escape. And this can happen at a very young age. So somehow, of course, I don't believe that it's possible even to genetically encode a dream, but somehow there has to be some kind of readiness in the brain to be sensitive to this type of information. And when children play, I mean, children love to play this kind of chase things as just like that you try to catch them and they run away and everybody's laughing.
Right.
So this kind of chase is somehow something they enjoy simulating also in the real world when they just play around. So it's very exciting for them. So I believe that it comes from a kind of interest in this sort of practicing how to get away from someone who is chasing you. And then this must activate some sort of a general scheme or script. And then it fills it in with some monster that you have seen in your fairy tale book or in the TV or maybe some animals that you have seen in the zoo or somewhere like that. So the dream can be a little bit, of course, different for everyone. What are the exact contents? Oh, the only thing that is universal is the sort of a script, what happens there. But can that be genetically coded? I don't know, but I'm very sort of impressed how it can be so universal that so many people, and especially children, experience the very, very same or very highly similar dreams. So how is it really transmitted, so to speak, to generation?
Well,
I would like to know that, but I don't know what the answer is.
Well, I think that was one of the things that Carl Jung wrestled with, and that led him to the concept of the archetypes.
Right,
which again are not specific images, but really more categories that we are sensitive to. I think it could be framed in that way.
Yeah, I think that's what I like about Jung's ideas is the concept of archetype, although his ideas were still different from this threat simulation idea, but there is something similar too. I think you're on the right track.
Uh-huh.
With that comparison, that perhaps we can somehow inherit some kind of archetypal forms of dreams, but then they become changed and there are many more variations of what can be threatening. So in our experience, our experiences mold these bad dreams and nightmares and threat simulations to many different directions, depending on what kind of threatening situations we encounter in the real world, like something like a computer virus in a laptop. It's certainly something that hunter-gatherers didn't know anything about. And also all those things that people pick up from horror movies, and then they have nightmares about them. So very often they're very fantastic kinds of threats and completely unrealistic, but still, because they made you afraid, it's the emotion. The emotion labels some of your experiences as potentially threatening, and then your memory and your dream production system takes those ingredients and somehow builds up this simulated threat around something that you felt fear or threat towards in your waking life. So So this is my idea how it works, then, that how is it possible that we can have so many different variations on this theme of threats. And of course it makes sense that we should practice for those threats that actually are here in our real environment, rather than the threats that were in the environment of hunter-gatherers. But it seems the result is some kind of a compromise. We have both these sorts of very ancient ancestral types of threats in our bad dreams and nightmares, and then we have very modern ones, especially when we grow up.
You sent me some of your articles, and in a 2009 article you sent, you outlined 6 assumptions that are critical for your theory. Can you remember them? I can't remember anything I wrote 2 weeks ago, so I don't know if you could take us through them or not.
Yeah. So I believe you are referring to the same 6 propositions that are kind of like the backbone of the threat simulation theory in general, which was originally published in 2000 in a theoretical article. So the first of them is exactly this idea that we can define dreaming as a simulation, or as an organized simulation, that if we just look at the data that we have from dream research, dreams are far too well organized to be the products of purely random chaotic stimulation in the brain or some kind of side effect. So if you accept that, if you accept that we can define dreaming as an organized world simulation, then we need to reject those theories that say it's a completely random process. And then...
Yeah, I rejected those a long time ago.
Yeah, but it's still pretty common, actually, pretty common idea in many theories to think that dreaming has no function of its own, that it's just a side effect of some other kind of a process going on. Maybe at the moment the most popular idea is that it's memory consolidation, that it's really happening in the brain, and somehow dreams are just side effects from that sort of leaking out some experiences which don't make sense or don't have a function, but they reflect the function of memory consolidation, which we know that the brain is doing memory consolidation during sleep. But the relationship between dreaming and memory consolidation is still unclear, but many people believe that dreaming doesn't contribute to it. It's just reflecting that.
Okay.
But then some of the other principles of the theory is that we can see that dreams are specialized, that it's a world simulation, and this world simulation is specialized in simulating threatening events. And this we can see exactly in these sorts of things that we were talking about, that the most universal dream themes, they are these kinds of rather primitive threats like being chased, being attacked. Earliest dreams in children are also like that, and they also reflect these kinds of lots of animals and these sorts of ancestral themes. And And then further principle is that this threat simulation system is activated by encountering real threats in your real life. And this is exactly what we see in most clearest form. We see it in post-traumatic nightmares, where some real experience leaves a very powerful emotional memory, and then the post-traumatic nightmares are built around those emotional memories, and this repetition of this dream goes on, and with different variations, like we already discussed, and then also this theory assumes that going through these kinds of threatening events in your dreams, that they will make you more prepared to react and respond to similar events in your real life. This, of course, is pretty difficult to test empirically, this principle. That did the hunter-gatherers really become better at detecting, for example, predators in their environment, or better and faster in hiding from them, or escaping from them, or anything like that, because they were dreaming about being chased or attacked and similar themes every night, very likely. So this is, of course, difficult to test. And then one principle in the theory also refers to what we now in general know about our evolutionary history, that during most of human evolutionary history, we lived as hunter-gatherers in an environment which was pretty full of various types of threats from nature, very natural types of threats, different from our modern world, and that originally dreaming evolved to handle those types of threats and to simulate those types of threats, and that at least in that environment, dreaming would have been useful and would have had a function in the biological sense, which means that dreaming a lot about the threats in that environment made you a better survivor in your waking life, because you had been prepared to be a little bit faster, quicker in responding and recognizing various threats in your environment. So it could have contributed to survival, and that's why it was selected for. That's why dreaming stayed with us and evolved towards being a better and better threat simulator. And we know, I was taking some of this evidence also up in these articles, that we know that, for example, life expectancy was very short in those days, that people lived on average 25 to 30 years only. So it means that the threat simulation system would have been most needed actually during perhaps quite early in life. So we would expect that people have the strongest and most sensitive dream life perhaps in their teenage years or early adulthood, because people died so young in that environment, partly because there were so many kinds of threats, that the threat simulation system would have had to be working with full steam from all through life to keep a person alive, even until it was possible to have your own offspring and to, in that sense, show that you were fit enough to survive, and then the dreaming as a threat simulator system would have been selected for, that those people who didn't have it maybe were less well dealing with threatening situations than the ones who were very skilled at picking up the threats and then getting prepared every night. So it's a bit like pilots. If you have pilots who don't use the flight simulator to practice various urgencies and dangerous situations, and then you have pilots who practice it regularly, then if something happens, it's more likely that the ones who are practicing will do the right responses when they are in flight, rather than those who just get confused. Okay, so what was this thing and how should we react now? So it's kind of plausible that it might have played that kind of role. And I think this kind of evolutionary perspective, it's rarely, at least at that point, it was quite rarely considered in theories of the function of dreaming. So it gives a little bit different notion for what a function is when we think about it in more biological terms.
Yeah, it really does. Now, to test your theory, you developed a content analysis dream threat rating scale designed to score the degree of threat in people's dream narratives. Tell us a little bit about the scale, how it was developed, and how you use it.
Yes. So at the same time when I came up with the threat simulation theory, I realized that, well, nobody's going to take the theoretical idea seriously unless it's going to be a testable theory. And in order to be able to test it, I realized, I tried to look at already existing content analysis scales, but I could not find any category of dream content there that would really correspond to the definition of a threatening situation. So I thought that, well, this means that I probably need to develop a scale that defines, well, what is a threatening event, a dangerous situation in a dream, and how can we quantify them or separate all those events from dreams, and then further look into what exactly is happening in those events, and are they as frequent as the theory would predict, and are the contents of those events in dreams, are they like what the theory would say they are? And at this point, I recruited a student that you may know, Katja Valli. She was a psychology student at that time and looking for a topic for her master's thesis. And then I offered this topic of developing together with me a scale by which we could do exactly that, quantify how much threatening events occur in dreams and what is their more detailed content. So first of all, we started to define how should we define a threatening event, and then we made several further categories. So what is interesting about those threatening events once we have defined them, and we made separate categories in this scoring system for identifying what is the source or the nature of the threat. Is it somebody being aggressive towards you, or is it some kind of natural catastrophe, or is it an accident kind of situation? Is it a disease or something like that? So we made a scale for the nature of the threat. Then who is being threatened? Is it the dream self? Is it some other familiar people in the dream? Are they strangers who are being threatened by those dream threats? Or is it not people, but it's just resources or valuables that are being threatened, or territory that is being threatened? So another scale, again, for the target of the threats. Then how does the dream self deal or respond to the threats? Are the responses or the actions and behaviors of the dream self, are they reasonable? Are they something that if this would be happening in real life, is the dream self doing something that would make sense as a real response if we assume that this is a real situation? And we had several other scales. Still, some of them we dropped later on, but with the help of this scale, then we started to analyze one data set that I had already earlier collected it. So before I even had the idea for the theory or for the scale. And our first study, the purpose was just to basically describe how frequent threats are in dreams. They were this kind of very typical sample of university students' home-reported dreams that we analyzed at that point. And then to report the frequency and the quality and whether they are somehow something along the lines that the theory would predict. And that was our first study. And already the first study showed that the threatening events in dreams are pretty frequent, that about two-thirds of the dream reports contain some kind of threatening event. And about 20% of those events were more dangerous than we would expect, like these kinds of students that are studying here in a safe country would ever encounter in their real life, so that they were clearly more dangerous, dealing with highly dangerous situations, even life-threatening situations, which are quite rare that people actually encounter such situations in their real life. So the results of the first study were quite promising in that regard, I was surprised that when you really pay attention particularly to that category, threatening events, that there is a lot of events in our dreams which are somehow threatening to someone in the dream. We defined threatening event in such a way that a threatening event, it is any event happening in the dream that if that event would happen in real life, then somebody's well-being would be endangered, or some kind of resources, valuable resources or territory would be in danger to be destroyed or stolen or something like that.
Yeah, so you found that there were a very high percentage of dreams like that in among your Scandinavian undergraduate students.
Right.
However, you later went on to study people who were traumatized by war in various hot spots around the world. What did you learn from these contrasting populations?
Yeah, that was something we really wanted to do, because this would be a sort of stronger test of the theory, because the theory says that this threat simulation system, it becomes more highly activated if the person lives in a real environment where threatening events are encountered and perceived in daily life, and more threatening events than what we usually encounter here in safe Western societies, but more akin to what life was like in the original evolutionary environment, which means that you encounter highly dangerous situations almost on a daily basis. But of course, it's difficult to find populations who live in this sort of an environment, but we then had the opportunity to collaborate with a dream researcher here in Finland who had already been collecting dreams in Iraq and in the Palestinian areas, and from children, especially children who had been exposed to warlike conditions, and then other children who had been living in more peaceful areas.
So what differences did you find?
Yes, so we had children's dreams reported from Palestinian children living in warlike zones or in peaceful zones, and then Kurdish children who were orphans, and part of them were very strict, very badly traumatized, others were not so badly traumatized. And then we had dreams from Finnish children living here in perfectly safe conditions. And the differences were very big between children living in completely safe environment here in Finland and children living in war zones or having encountered very much violence and all sorts of things living there. So the Finnish children had only in 30% of their dreams we identified threatening events, whereas the most highly traumatized group of Kurdish children who were orphans and had gone through most traumatic kind of life, it was 80% of their dreams contained threatening events. So almost all of their dreams contained threatening events, and also the nature of the threats that they dreamt about was much more dangerous. So they were dreaming about threats to their physical safety and life, about situations that they had witnessed or heard about that were pretty bad.
Yeah, so that's
kinds of things.
That's pretty much what one would expect, I would think. Does your theory impact or modify approaches to dream interpretation?
Well, it's difficult to say because this is not really directly connected to any symbolic sort of dream interpretation.
Okay.
That we deal with the manifest content, and the content analysis takes literally whatever contents are reported, and not trying to make a symbolic interpretation of that. Actually, some of the commentators of the theory were suggesting that what if the, let's say that so children dream quite often about wild beasts like wolves or bears being they are chased by these kinds of wild animals, but what if those animals are just symbols of some kind of childhood fears and so forth? Of course, it's possible, but it's difficult to go down that lane that you start to not take the dream contents for what they literally are, because then it's the question is, okay, so what are they if they are not what they are supposed to be?
Yeah.
So we stick to the literal interpretation, the manifest content.
Okay.
Well, let
me ask you a related question then. Does your theory have clinical implications or applications, do you think?
Yeah, I think it does, in the sense that people who suffer from, well, maybe chronic nightmares or post-traumatic nightmares, and I've talked with several people who, although I'm not a clinician, but when I go around and I give lectures on dreaming, and I tell about threat simulation theory as well, and sometimes also people just ask about their horrible nightmares and why they have them. And I've noticed that actually people find the explanation quite relieving when I tell them that, yeah, well, you know, your dreams, even if they feel horrible to have that kind of nightmares, but the original purpose really is to try to protect you, because if it is a system that evolved the purpose was to keep the person alive if that kind of horrible, threatening situations are faced in the real world. So it's just a sort of compulsory training session that your brain puts you through every night. It tries to make you a better survivor, and it's a stupid system. It doesn't understand that it was only a horror movie, or it doesn't understand that if you experience something terrible in the distant past, that this will never happen again. In that sense, it's a stupid system. It just looks into your emotional memory. It picks up your strongest negative emotions from there and the events that they were connected to.
Yeah.
And then it recycles that into a threat scenario. And it puts you into the center, and you are the one usually who is being threatened. So even if you see a horror movie, and they are completely fictional characters who are being threatened by fictional enemies, but then when you dream about it, it's you, and the enemies are somehow already part of your life, or you have been transported magically to the world of the horror movie. But all of the purpose of this system is to originally to make you a better survivor. So it's trying to protect you, and people find this explanation kind of relieving because, oh, but that's nice. So it means I'm not crazy even if I have all these horrible nightmares where all kinds of really evil beasts and try to kill, and that they see this kind of scenery, which is, of course, horrifying because it comes from horror movies and very scary stuff.
Yeah.
But people get it. This theory is not complicated. It sort of makes sense when you hear about it.
Yeah.
And then I can tell them, yeah, just relax. It just means your brain is really good at protecting you. It's just like, you know, our immunity responses. I mean, they try to protect us from microbes. It doesn't feel nice when you have all the symptoms on, if you get fever and whatever, but it's still trying to protect you.
Yeah.
So it's a bit the same with nightmares and bad dreams, that they are for your protection, even if they feel horrible. But you can just take them as compulsory rehearsals, training sessions that have been pre-programmed into your brain.
Yeah, I can see that would be a helpful way to reframe it for some people. Where do you see your work going in the future? What are the unanswered questions for you?
Yeah, of course, this theory also got a lot of criticism because, like any theory would, and one of the major criticisms was that, yeah, well, even if this theory would somehow be plausible in the case of bad dreams and nightmares and recurrent dreams, there is still a very large proportion of dreams which are neutral or positive. So how do we explain those dreams? I just didn't have an explanation for them. I just used to be thinking that either they don't have any function at all or they must have an independent function. And now recently I have been given more thought about what could be a function that is independent of threat simulation but would still be also some kind of simulation function. And the most plausible theory there or theoretical idea would be that positive dreams and neutral dreams might be simulating social interactions, social skills, and strengthening our social bonds. And last year, me and together with my colleagues, we formulated this into what we call the social simulation theory.
Uh-huh.
Of dreaming.
Yeah.
And some other people have already previously talked about the possibility that dreams could be social simulations, but nobody has really formulated in a very strict manner as a real testable theory. So this is what me and my colleagues have been doing recently, and now we are, in a way, planning to do exactly like we did previously with the threat simulation theory, that now we want to make some clear predictions and tests of do the social contents of dreams, social interactions in dreams, are they such that they could serve a function as that kind of a theory would predict? So we are now trying to pick all the different social interactions and then test if they behave in the way that we would expect them to behave if they are functional.
Oh, that sounds very promising. I'll be looking forward to seeing your results somewhere down the line. Now, just as we're wrapping it up here, the topic that you'll be speaking on at the upcoming IASD conference in June is towards a unified science of dreaming and consciousness. And you referred to consciousness at the beginning of our conversation, that was something that interested you all along. Without giving the whole talk away, what can you tell us about that here, just briefly?
So initially, I was really interested in the problem of consciousness as such, which is a huge topic in psychology and neuroscience. And there I believe that we can actually understand consciousness much better by looking at altered states of consciousness, and in particular dreaming, and by understanding that both dreaming and our waking consciousness are pretty much the same phenomenon, but our waking consciousness is like an online consciousness and dreaming consciousness like an offline consciousness, simulation.
Yeah.
But it's the same phenomenon generated in the same way inside the brain, but it's just how it is connected to the external world that is the difference. And then from that idea that consciousness in general, it is a world simulation. Our brain simulates a world also when we perceive the world, but it just uses the information that comes through our senses in wakefulness. In dreaming, it uses our memories. Then this general idea of consciousness as a world simulation led to these theoretical ideas of trying to understand dreaming as a virtual reality or world simulation. And ever since then, I have been working on these simulation theories and simulation functions of dreaming. So in that sense, the ideas that I have all the way from the philosophy of consciousness and neuroscience of consciousness, I think they connect very nicely with how we could make better sense of what dreams really are, what dreaming really is, and what it is for, what are the functions of dreaming. So it, in that sense, I believe that the science of dreaming and the science of consciousness might be nicely unified under an understanding that they are just variations of what is at its core the same phenomenon.
Yeah. Well, you're really wrapping your arms around some very large ideas and concepts, and you've given us a lot to think about. So I really want to thank you. And so Dr. Antti Revonsuo, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. I enjoyed.
Believe it or not, I had a number of other questions for Dr. Revonsuo that we didn't have time for. For example, I planned to ask, let me play devil's advocate here. Isn't that a stretch to think that a paper and pencil rating scale can confirm something that goes so far back into prehistoric times? What about your findings convinces you that your theory is being confirmed? Due to the new imaging technologies developed in recent years, we've learned a lot about brain centers and networks. Have you been able to correlate any of this information from neuroscience with your own theory? Do you think that your threat theory provides an adequate accounting for all dreams? For example, dreams that have no threat, such as flying dreams, teeth falling out dreams, love/sex dreams, spiritual dreams, precognitive dreams, lucid dreams. Your theory is an evolutionary one. Are there any competing evolutionary theories? What can you tell us about them? It wasn't just time that constrained me from asking these questions. In some cases, I didn't ask the question because he had at least spoken to it partially, or his reply could pretty much be deduced from other things he said. The idea that has most impact on me, and that I find myself still turning over in my mind, is his conception of the brain as a virtual reality machine. I'm not aware of anyone else formulating it in quite that way. Psychology has a long history of grabbing metaphors from science and other fields. In recent times, for example, the brain has been likened to a computer. And of course, there are similarities, but we know that it doesn't operate in exactly the same way. And virtual reality is very au courant. His use of the term to understand the brain in relation to dreaming is very compelling to me, I must say. Finally, I should mention that Dr. Revansuo does have several books on Amazon.com, the most recent of which is his 2010 Consciousness, The Science of Subjectivity. You can purchase it by clicking on our Amazon affiliate widget in the right-hand sidebar on our site, and we'll get a small percentage of the sale.
Thomas here from upstate New York. I just want to say that I listened to my first podcast, number 354, What Aging Men Want, and I was prompted immediately to make a modest donation of $20. First, because I received the most prompt and personal customer service I have ever gotten when I called in a question to Dr. Dave about shrink wrap radio. But much more significantly, after listening to just one program, I was inspired to get off the dime I had been sitting on procrastinating for weeks about contacting a shrink. And to boot, as a result of Dr. Robinson's interview, I have picked up a copy of The Odyssey to reread after 50 years since reading it the first time in high school. If you are into value, think about what you get. In today's economy, where a $20 bill doesn't buy you what a $10 bill bought in a grocery store just a year ago, you get with Shrink Wrap Radio hundreds of entertaining, insightful, and helpful discussions. They are free. Yes, indeed, and that is real value. But still, to help out with a few bucks, it is still real value when you think of this vast resource just waiting for you to discover new areas of enlightenment. Myself, I hate exercising, but I love listening. And now I'm walking more and longer, because I am now listening to Shrink Wrap Radio on my MP3 player. Chip in and you will get a lot of value for your contribution, and you will feel good about doing so, just as I did. Thanks.
Tom in New York, thanks for your donation and for encouraging others to chip in. I really appreciate your donation and all those others out there who have done so as well. I'm happy to announce that we do have one new donor since the last episode, and it's none other than Mariana Naldi, who for a long time was the resident blogger for our newsletter. Mariana, I'm glad to see that Shrink Wrap Radio is still important to you. Thanks for becoming a financial contributor. I'm happy to announce that we do have a new transcript on the site. It's number 470, The Cycle of Life, with Israeli Jungian analyst Arel Shalit, thanks to listener and transcriber Ellie Nobbs. Listen up, if you are anywhere in the Boston area, the C.G. Jung Institute of Boston is dedicated to the study and dissemination of the psychological theories and methods originated by Carl Gustav Jung. And the Jung Institute is a gathering place for self-discovery and for the exploration of Jungian-oriented thoughts and ideas. Here's the important part. On April 1st and 2nd, it will be hosting its biannual visiting lecture series. And for this spring's program, the visiting lecturer will be David Shane. That's spelled S-C-H-O-E-N, by the way. Author of The War of the Gods and Addiction. And I might point out, Dr. Shane is also a former guest of Shrink Wrap Radio on podcast number 331. Well, he'll be speaking on Friday night at the Jung Institute in Newton, Massachusetts, on The War of the Gods and Addiction, The Psychodynamics of Addiction, Treatment, and Recovery. Then on that Saturday, there will be an all-day workshop held at Brandeis University's Mandel Center on the Archetypal Evil of Addiction in Fairy Tales, Myth, and Religion. For more information and to register, go to www.cgjungboston.com. There you will also be able to check out their spring public programs lineup, find an analyst, check out the analyst and auditor training programs, become a sponsoring friend of Jung. You will also be able to friend the Boston Jung Institute on Facebook and follow them on Twitter. Time is running out on the Zur CE credits discount. Now through March 31st, you can get 20% off by entering discount code ZUR180. That's ZUR180 at checkout. And the URL to go to is www.zurinstitute.com/dvannize.html. And as I mentioned before, you may have noticed that I've been putting up 5-minute or so video clips of some of my recent interviews, and I've started to make full-length videos of some of these interviews available on the Shrink Wrap Radio YouTube site. Did you know there was such a site on YouTube? I think you can find it. Up until quite recently, I had assumed that my listeners would not be interested in full-length video. Please let me know if that's an option you'd be likely to use. In fact, to make it easy for you, I've put a poll in the right-hand column on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. Just scroll down past all the book ads and you'll see the poll, which puts the question to you, are you likely to go to my Shrink Wrap Radio YouTube site to see full-length videos of some of my interviews, yes or no? And speaking of those interviews, if you are interested in knowing more about me and how I got into podcasting and so on, Australian listener and podcaster Amy Fellman made a full-length video of her interview with me. She was very successful in making me comfortable and drawing me out. And you can find a link to that full-length video by going to the In the Media tab on the Shrink Wrap Radio site. Actually, there's a link there to the audio only and another to the video plus audio, depending upon which you prefer. And I also highly recommend Amy's psychology podcast, which is called We All Wear It Differently. Now, I know I gave that same information last week, but I just wanted to put it out there one more time. And also, this is episode number 499, which means the next one will be number 500, which should be considered a pretty significant milestone. But instead of preparing anything specifically to celebrate that milestone, I think that the interview that Amy did with me serves that purpose really well.
Hi, this is Jaak Panksepp, neuroscientist and author of The Archaeology of Mind, and you are on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Jaak Panksepp, whom I interviewed on Shrink Wrap Radio number 329, The Emotional Foundation of Mind. Now let's go to some recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Sergio in Italy, who writes, "Hello, I think your interviews provide quality psychological education at no cost. I found no free source comparable to yours anywhere online. The podcast depth is very good. Regards, Sergio." Sergio and I had a bit of more of an email exchange, and I found out that he is a dedicated student and also an author. So coming from you, Sergio, that's your feedback is a high compliment. Next, we hear from longtime listener and frequent correspondent Mayar in Tehran, who writes, "It's been a while since I've written you, and I thought today, why not drop a line or two? We're getting close to the New Year holiday here and spring. You can imagine how the spring sun is shining as we're nearing the holidays. More and more people will set off for trips around or outside the country, and so one can get all the usually overloaded streets to oneself if they stay in Tehran. And I shall stay. I really like this face of Tehran, which one can see only 1 or 2 weeks each year. And it was great to hear your recent interview with Professor Hermans. I once translated an interview Dr. Gorbani had with him for a journal run by Dr. Gorbani in Persian. But the good thing is that now I know nothing does interest me the way that psychoanalysis does. And this very recognition allows me to enjoy the many other things I come across more than before. Anyway, I just wanted to renew our connection as the season is changing and see how you're doing at the threshold of this translation. All the best, and that's from Mayar. Mayar, it's always good to hear from you and to get a sense of what's going on there in Tehran. I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014, or you can use our app for that, and you'll find full information about our app on the site under the Apps tab. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Antti Revonsuo, for sharing his evolutionary threat theory of dreaming. My next guest will be author Beverly Stokes, who works with movement to enhance social and cognitive development of infants during their first 6 months. This should be very, very interesting. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.